my name is Laura Vogt, and I'm the Communications and Events Manager for Engineering Student Services, and welcome to this week's episode of the Not-So-Secret Guide to Being a Berkeley Engineer. This week, we're excited. We've got Denilyn Mallari and Henry Tsai from UC Berkeley Undergraduate Admissions. Today, we're discussing students that are applying as incoming freshmen to Berkeley Engineering. So it's a little different than what we normally do. Our podcast has been geared to our current students. So this is nice because it's for those folks that are looking at coming in and want to know a little bit more about admissions. Denilyn, would you please tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me. My name is Denilyn Mallari. I'm an assistant director in the Office of Undergraduate Admissions here at UC Berkeley.
Thank you. And thank you for coming for the first time over here to our little podcast. Henry, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? I know you came with us last year.
Yes. Thanks for having me again. And my name is Henry Tsai. I'm also an assistant director of undergraduate admissions at UC Berkeley.
And thank you. I really do appreciate you taking your time and coming over here and talking with us a little bit. And so let's start it off with the application dates. I know we're in November now, so those are the important things that we got to remember, right?
Yeah, so the application opens every year August 1st, and the submission period is the entire month of November. November 1st, students can start submitting. It is due November 30th, 11:59 p.m. Pacific time.
Excellent. And does it matter when you get your application in? Like, is it look better if you turn it at the beginning of the month versus the end of the month?
Makes no difference whatsoever between November 2nd, November 22nd. It has no impact whatsoever on the application.
Just make sure you give yourself time, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, we do see not a lot, but enough where students panic and 11, p.m. and then their computer decides not to work or whatever, life happens. So definitely give yourself that time.
Excellent. And once students have applied, when do they find out if they've been accepted?
Sure. So we try to release our decisions by the end of March. There's no specific date just yet, but usually by the end of March is when we'll release our freshman decisions.
And that's so that we've got a Cal Day that comes up in April that kind of welcomes everyone that's been accepted.
Yeah, exactly. And so definitely check out the Cal Day website to see when that is. But yeah, that's exactly why we have it at the end of March. And that leads right into Cal Day.
And what exactly is part of the application process? Are there essays? Do they have to do letters of reference or letters of recommendation or anything along those lines?
Yeah, letters of rec are a part of our process, but it's only for a very small number of students. So it's not for everyone, and it's not a positive or a negative thing if you are asked or if you are not asked for a letter of rec. So don't share the link. It's not going to work for other people when you get it in your email. And you can choose to have two people to write letters of rec for you. One of them we prefer to have a academic person, I guess, write you a letter of rec. So it could be a teacher, a counselor of that sort. And then the other one could be anybody you want who knows you pretty well, to answer the other letter of recommendation. So don't worry if you aren't asked or if you are. It doesn't mean you're in or out either way.
It is an invitation that comes out to students after they submit their application. So it's not something that's a part of the application initially.
Okay.
The students may be invited to submit up to two, as Henry mentioned. With the overall, or as I should say, the initial application, some components of it are the academic history. It's entirely self-reported, so it's really helpful to have an unofficial transcript in front of you for the applicants who are reporting all of those grades, each of the classes, the types of classes they're taking, things of that sort. They'll also write a little bit about their extracurricular involvement, special program participation, awards and honors, and then we do have, as you mentioned, our essays. They are called the personal insight questions. Logistically, there are 8 options from which students will choose 4, and for each of those 4 questions, students have up to 350 words with which to respond. So those are the components of the application.
Okay, and how important are the personal essays to the application process? I had someone ask me this yesterday.
Sure, so we do conduct a holistic review, so while we wouldn't say there's a formula or any kind of percentage assigned to any one component of the application, I'd like to argue that the personal insight questions are impactful because it's really an opportunity for students to use their own voice to really share with us their experiences, talk about their extracurricular involvements, their lived experiences, to really give us the context with which to understand their entire application. So while I mentioned earlier the components are the academic record, extracurriculars, all of that, I like to frame it as, while I can see all of that information, the personal insight questions sessions really are an opportunity for students to provide the lens through which to understand all of those pieces.
And when you were talking about the essays, is there any one particular question that you think is more important for them to answer?
Not at all. The eight are viewed as equally as any others, and we would prefer students to choose the ones that really speak to them. They read the question and say, "Oh, wow, I have a lot to say about this." That's the one we want them to write. So there's no preference. I would rather not read the same four for 100,000 applications.
Right.
And when we're talking about the extracurricular activities, I had someone ask me, is it better to do one activity and do everything about it and be really involved in that one? Or do you want to see them spread out and do a couple different extracurricular activities?
Yeah, we would like to see whatever really kind of fits in the student's narrative and in their life, really. So there's no really one or three or five or ten. Usually we see students have multiple areas of interest, and so that's great. Usually we don't see just one. So just in general, don't feel like you have to limit yourself or overextend yourself. That's kind of the message that we would like to get out there. What does it mean for you to participate in these activities? How much time does it take for you to participate in these activities? And in depth, so not 400 activities and one day out of the year and that's it. It's more about the depth and how much you're gaining out of the activity versus the number, and balancing that with your grades and the classes you're taking. So it all has to make sense for you. That's okay. Kind of the idea.
And does it matter if it's a public service extracurricular activity or if it's being banned or debate or the robotics club?
It can honestly be whatever it is that the student's interested in. It could be related to their academic interests or field of interest, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. I like to tell students that it's not only what you do, but why you do it. So you're able to speak to, in your personal insight questions, your additional comments, you're able to speak to why you dedicate this time and this effort to this particular activity. So we don't look for a specific type of activity or involvement. It really is what is the student doing outside of the classroom and why.
Okay. Talking more about the academic side of it, if we switch gears just a little bit, is there a specific GPA that we're looking for?
No. We do not have a minimum requirement for a GPA, and there's a maximum. You can get a 4.0 or a 5.0, I guess. No, there's not one that we're looking for. GPAs themselves could tell us a lot of different stories, depending on the student's context. Even from if you just have a 4.0 versus another student's 4.0, it could tell me different things, depending on how many honors and APs and all that stuff that you're taking. So, no, there's not a single number or a range of numbers that we're looking for. Now, a lot of students take a look at our brochures or look on our website and see an average. That is an average that happens after all the students are admitted, and we just look at the average. So it's not something where we pay attention to while we're reading applications. Oh, this student does not fall into this range, and so therefore we're not going to admit them. That's not how it works. It's just something that we pull out after all the students are admitted.
Yeah, I think speaking to the GPA, it's one piece of the whole that we're looking at with holistic review, particularly with the academic record. That GPA tells one piece of the story, but we're also looking at the types of classes students are taking. So I like to remind students that a 3.5 looks very different between taking just the basic core curriculum versus a 3.5 with, say, challenging courses like honors and AP classes. So it's usually a combination of those things. So we are looking at the overall context of that academic record.
Okay. When we were talking about what classes they should take, I know a lot of our students come in with a lot of AP courses. Mm-hmm. Are there specific ones that you would suggest that they try to take if it's available at their school?
Yeah, so with students who are interested in the College of Engineering, it's also always really helpful to have a really set foundation in the subjects of math and science specifically, which I think students usually assume is the case. So taking the highest level of math and science at their school that's available is always really helpful, because we want students to be prepared for success once they get to our campus and are able to address and take on the challenge of the academic rigor, particularly within the College of Engineering on our campus. So I won't name all all of the AP classes, but just considering, again, the context of the school that you're coming from and what is available, that's also something that we consider, that not every school has every challenging AP math and science course. And so, again, we are considering the context of the school you're coming from. But as far as what is available, challenging yourself within that is always really helpful.
And another thing I'd like to add is the a lot of times we see students with scheduling conflicts in between AP exams, AP classes. So if they have, I don't know, 15 AP classes available to you at your school and you took, you know, six or seven, if you have scheduling conflicts, then feel free to tell us that and say, okay, I couldn't take these two together because they're at the exact same time. You know,
okay.
So some those little contextual information can help us determine, hey, what's going on. You have 15 and you took, you know, three or five or whatever. What was going on there?
And do you have a list, or do you know some way of what schools had 27 AP classes and what schools were only able to offer four?
We do, for the most part. So we do ask counselors at every high school that we have access to send us what we call a school profile. And in those school profiles, counselors are able to report, these are the types of AP courses available. Here's the number. We also aren't necessarily talking about it, but IB courses as well are included in that number, as well as in what we consider challenging courses. But that's context that we can get from the school profile. It's also something that students can report to us in the application, whether through their additional comments sections, if they want to talk about it in their personal insight questions, that's a space as well.
Okay.
But it usually is context that we receive from the school directly.
Let's go back and look at talk about the personal essays a little bit. Are there any of the topics that when people answer the questions that have become too cliched, that you've heard the same story over and over again, that maybe people can either expand on it or try to find a different way to answer the question?
I guess, in a sense, yes, there is a way that students respond that becomes commonplace. And the only thing I would say about that is that it's because students tend to stay very, very general. So the information they're giving us is all big concepts and big ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, it's very general. If it's very general, that the word says general, so it becomes commonplace. So what we like to see is that students dig deep a little bit and tell us about themselves and their own motivations. Why are you doing something, or why is something impactful to you? In that case, if they do dig deep a little bit and give us more about themselves, then it becomes not common, and it becomes unique, and it becomes who they are and what they can tell us about themselves. It requires a little bit of reflection, or a lot of reflection, hopefully, and something unique to them. If it's a true story of them and they're digging deep, then it becomes unique. That alone will make it unique. The cliche, the commonplace, is when everything is just super general and you're just saying, I persevered. Well, what does that mean? I don't know what perseverance means for you, right? It's a very common idea. What does that mean? So it's when it becomes cliche, when it's general.
Yeah, and I think if I can add on a little bit more, I think Henry's also talking a lot about the style of writing that students write in.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of content, I think I get a lot of students who ask me, well, my best friend is my co-president. We have the same exact experiences. We're in the same exact clubs. Is there a concern from an admissions reader of reading the same exact thing? I like to remind students that their perception and their point of view and the perspective, I should say, it really is independent of all of their friends. You might be having the same exact experiences. You might be coming from the exact same, if not similar, backgrounds. But you get to speak to your truth and your narrative. And I think that's really important for students to know, that we're looking for their story, and they're the best person to tell us that story.
And last year we had talked a little bit about some students might get too technical if they're talking about a project that they're doing, especially in engineering. So is that still kind of the same idea of try to explain things in a layman's terms, maybe?
Yeah, we never know who's going to be reading your applications. We're all trained the same way to read applications, to understand and take context from an application, but do try to take the perspective of somebody who isn't quite in that same mindset of, oh, I know all of this terminology, all of the jargon that you might know. And I think focusing not so much just on the project itself, but really the impact it's had or your leadership role in it. And it's really talking about that and not so much just the project.
Yeah, think of these as the title of these are called, or the personal insight questions. And so it's not a technical manual that you have to recite or anything.
Right.
It's a personal insight question. So that's where you have to kind of bring it back. If something has to be said about this project that is technical, sure, put it in there. It's what it's called. But other than that, it should be, as Denilin said, what is it about it that you got a lot out of, that you learned, that you influenced, that you led, that you followed, but in a very impactful way for you. All this information is a lot more relevant than as many technical terms as I can throw into 350 mm-hmm. words.
And last year, just as a side anecdote, we heard in the news a lot about a student who wrote his application essay that just said, pick me, or something along those lines, where it just said the same thing over and over again. Because it's a holistic review, that's not necessarily going to get you anywhere, right?
It's not helpful. It really doesn't help us learn about a student. I like to assume when I'm reading an application, a student wants us to pick them, right? And so you don't have to tell me that you're applying to our school. It says it on its own. What's most helpful in these personal insight questions, as we said earlier, it really is tell us your story, tell us who you are. I can't make assumptions about your application, and I would hope that applicants don't want us to make assumptions, and so they get to fill in those gaps and provide those details for us to consider. I say experience is a lot, but we're considering your achievements in the context of your life. We're considering your family responsibilities. We're considering your home life, and like I said, you get to tell that story to us, so we get to consider all of that in the holistic way in your application.
So let's talk a little bit more about actually when you're choosing your major to come to UC Berkeley. I know within the College of Engineering, we're really specific about when you choose your major, you're coming in as either electrical engineering and computer science, or you're coming in as mechanical engineering. Is there a way once you get here to change? So what if you got accepted into letters and science instead of engineering?
Yeah, so it's going to be incredibly, incredibly difficult for you to what we call a change of college. From letters and science or natural resources, environmental design, and change into College of Engineering after you get to Berkeley. So if you, even though it is very difficult and it's competitive to get into the College of Engineering, if you know you want engineering, then apply to the College of Engineering. Within engineering, I believe you can change to different majors and things like that within. But again, if you think it's hard to get into Berkeley, try to do that change of college. It'll be very, very difficult.
I know our line on CalDave, when we meet a lot of students that are trying to decide which college to go to, is if you got accepted into letters and science, but you really want to do electrical engineering and computer science, and you got into a different college where you're actually in that major, mm-hmm. we suggest doing that. We don't actually take any transfers or change of college into engineering. Electrical engineering and computer science is. And then a lot of the other ones are impacted, but I know it's difficult.
It is.
We have a lot of people that apply and a lot of people that we're not able to accept. So
exactly. It's
hard to make everything work out.
Right. And we get that question all the time on the road, which major or which college should mm-hmm. I apply to? And then, you know, let's just say, and they try to be, you know, sly about it or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
What if I want to do engineering later? Maybe way back when, I don't know where this myth came from, but ever since I've been around, it's been 7 or 8 years now, this hasn't been the case. You can't, or it's extremely, 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 extremely difficult to do a change of college. So, yeah.
Right. I mean, if students are open to considering computer science as a major, we do have that in the College of Letters and Science, so that is an option for students who are admitted, but it really does take some understanding of the differences between the two, where computer science may be the same between the two majors, but it does, in the College of Letters and Science, it doesn't quite have that electrical engineering aspect of it, and if that's something that's really important to students, then it really is, the decision is up to them of what do they want with their degree, and if that's not here at Berkeley because they're not admitted already or enrolled in the College of Engineering, then that's definitely something that's important for them to consider.
There's also in the College of Letters and Science, the computer science major, if you're admitted in the College of Letters and Science and you want computer science, that's something that you'll have to declare at the end of your second year. So that means you're going to need to fulfill their requirements. So you're not in that major right away. Whereas if you're in the College of Engineering, you're in that major right away. You're admitted to that major, and there's no other sort of set of circumstances or criteria that you need to meet to be in that major. So that's a big difference where you have to meet another set of requirements to get into the College of Letters and Science computer science major. So if you're debating on which one to get into, actually they're equally hard to get into. One is just in the beginning, freshman, if you will, and then the other one is after your second year. Hopefully you've met the requirements.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think that the thing to really get out of this is we don't do change of college for EECs. It's not, we just don't have the capacity to do it. So definitely take that into consideration when you're picking what your major is. And I know it seems funny to just single out EECs, but that's the big one right now that
really,
we have a lot of people
it really
at.
Is. Sure. It's true.
Absolutely.
And is there any downfalls to applying to multiple universities within the UC system? I know you get to select when you're doing your application.
Yeah, no, not at all. So a lot of students will ask me, if I get into this campus, will I not get into another UC campus, this, that, and the other? If I get into another one, we don't consider that. And I actually can't see, we can't see which campuses a student is applying to unless they explicitly state which ones they're applying to in their application.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there, it makes no difference. And our hope is actually that they are applying broadly within the UC system.
In the preparation of getting ready to come here, if we look at that for the standardized tests that the students have to take, we've got quite a few questions about, is it better to do the SAT or the ACT? Mm-hmm. What extra tests do they have to, the subject tests should they do?
Yeah, you definitely have to take either the SAT or the ACT, even if you are an international student.
Mm-hmm. With writing.
With writing, thank you. Thank you. Yes, with writing. So, but there's no preference. Either one, whichever one you feel most comfortable with, or take all of them and just send us all of them. What we'll do is we'll look at the highest sitting score. So we do not super score. We just take the highest sitting. Mm-hmm. For subject exams, SAT2s or SAT subject exams, they are not required at all. A lot of students do get in without taking them. But if you do decide to take them, or you can and you know you're going to do well, then take a math level 2 and a science that's related to your major. Bioengineering, take bio. And things like that. So, again, there's no preference for either one, and you do not have to take them. But think of your application as evidence or reasons to admit you. If you have more reasons and you take the SAT2s and you do well, then that's more reasons to admit you. So it's not required, but it could definitely help.
Mm-hmm. And just to add on to that, as we mentioned earlier, with math and science being really pivotal and integral to success in the College of Engineering and checking for that in your foundational courses in high school, taking those SAT subject exams can be helpful in showing your academic achievement again in those subjects.
Oh, okay. And I should have asked this earlier. I'm going to
sure.
Over. But for the AP classes, how many AP classes will actually transfer to UC Berkeley? Should you stop at a certain amount because you don't think it's going to count for anything? Or?
Yeah, I believe Berkeley is a little different than the other UCs in this respect. Mm-hmm. So all the AP exams that you take that you get a 3 or above will you'll have units when you come to Berkeley. So there's no limit. So you could have 5 to 20 to 30 to 40, and depending on how many AP exams you take. You could have all those units. Not all of them will take the place of a course, and it's up to your advisors and the college to dictate that. So the other units could be elective or whatever, and your college will kind of determine that once you get here. But there's no limit to how many units you can have when you bring to Berkeley. Now, when you come to Berkeley, other UCs might have different policies on that, so definitely check with the UCs, mm-hmm. The UC schools that you want to apply to and see what their policies are.
Yeah, and similar to that, also IB courses or IB exams, we accept higher level 5, 6, and 7 with very similar things to what Henry said.
Oh, okay. So when you come in, you're coming in with however many units of classes that you took already.
Right, exactly.
And how likely is it that a student's actually going to be accepted?
Oh, that's always hard to
say. Like a percentage of...
Do we know a percentage? I know for engineering, we're pretty competitive.
We are. So for UC Berkeley, our fall 2018 admissions, we had about an 18% admit rate.
Okay.
And so to contextualize, College of Engineering usually teeters between around 8 to 10%. It does depend, so that's why I hesitate a little bit within the specific number, because it can vary. Depending on the applicant pool, every year it does shift a little bit. Mm-hmm. But as you said, the College of Engineering overall is very, very selective.
But that doesn't mean to not apply.
Right. No, of course not. Exactly. So it's not impossible to get in. So again, it's really helpful in that holistic review to understand where a student is coming from, not just their academics. While, of course, academics are absolutely an important part of the entire equation, if you will, we are looking at what else a student is doing. So with holistic review, it is that academic as well as non-academic achievement in terms of what are they doing outside of the classroom, what other academic opportunities or extracurricular opportunities are they taking advantage of. So it's definitely not impossible to get in. It's just a matter of doing really well in the courses that you're taking and really speaking to your experiences and your strengths in your application.
A lot of students ask me that once they hear about the percentages and things like that. And I always like to kind of tell them something that's weirdly profound to them, although it's not to me. Maybe I've just been doing this for a long time. But there's one guarantee here, and we can say this as an absolute fact. If you do not apply, you're mm-hmm. definitely not going to get in.
Right.
That's
true.
Yeah. So that's that kind of it's obvious, duh. But honestly, that when you self-select out, just even if it's a hard school to get into or whatever, you take yourself out of the pool. That's it. So, you know, if you really have a passion for something and you really want to try it, give it a shot.
And is there a way, speaking on that, if somebody was worried about it's costing too much to apply to a bunch of different schools, is there something to help them pay for the application fees?
Yeah, sure. So in the application itself, some students can essentially apply for a fee waiver for up to 4 schools. Okay. As I mentioned, it is all calculated in the UC application. It's a consideration of the annual family income and the family size. So there are just a couple of things that we take into account. So some students can be eligible for that fee waiver, like I said, for up to 4 campuses. There are also other fee waivers. So I always recommend students talk to their counselors at their school. There are things called College Board waivers. We have our NACAC waiver. So I know those are things that students may or may not be familiar with, but again, I always recommend speaking with a counselor at their school.
So don't let... There's things out there and resources for you to try to help you apply. Don't self-select out just because you're worried about money
right.
or anything along those lines.
Exactly.
Tell us more about the wait list. What does it mean? How do the students get on it?
Okay, so the wait list is something that we use every year in a very specific manner, in the sense that we actually use it. Some colleges have a wait list, but they don't really go to it for whatever reason. For us, it is part of our process. So if you are put on the wait list, it is a possibility that you'll get in. Every year, it depends, and it varies in regards to who and how many students, well, how many, not who, I guess, how many students get in. And it depends on the how many students decide to come in that first wave when all the decisions go out. And students by May 1st need to tell us if they're coming or not. So how many students say yes? So that basically dictates the wait list. If it's low 1 year, then we'll have more that will admit off the wait list and vice versa. So it is a tool that we use to make sure we can gather as many students as we can and not over admit. If you over admit, then resources dwindle, right? You have too many students for the number of resources available on campus. So it's very important to us in a logistical sense. So that's something that we use very strategically in helping us manage that process.
Yeah, and so it's important for students if they are put on the wait list, the decision that they can make is whether they opt into that wait list.
Okay.
So opting in means that they're like, okay, I'll stay on the wait list, I'll wait a little bit for the decision to come out. And we may admit students from the wait list, and I think every year, again, it changes for us to who commits to our campus, things of that sort. But I think the biggest thing for students to know is that if they are put on the wait list, whether to opt in or to not opt in. If students don't opt in, it's very similar to what Henry said earlier, that if you don't opt in, you're just no longer considered for admission to UC Berkeley. But if students are like, I'm going to hold out hope and I'm going to stay on this wait list, they do have to opt in. And the deadline is very soon, I think, after that, those first decisions come out.
Also, to add is we get questions like, should I say I want to go to a different institution while I'm waiting on the wait list? The answer is yes. Don't give up a chance that you have already in the bag, if you will.
Right.
Somebody has admitted you already. Say yes to that campus if you can. I don't know what their policies on our wait list and whatnot. But if you can, then say yes to that campus. That way you have a spot somewhere else. And don't give up that spot, because a wait list is not a guarantee.
Right.
Depending on the numbers that come in every year, then you may lose that spot if you don't say yes to that campus and you're waiting on our wait list.
And so when do you find out if you're on the wait list? When do you start releasing or application offers, or not application, but admission offers?
Sure. So we do try to release those decisions in late March, or by the end of March. And so that's for everyone, for students for whom we are accepting admission, for students who were not offering admission, as well as students who are accepting onto the wait list. And then after, I think, May 1st, as Henry said, that's when we're, that's essentially the national deadline for students to accept their offer of admission. And after that, we have more of an idea of, here are some more opportunities and spaces we have available to admit students into. And so it's kind of on a, I don't want to say rolling basis, but it kind of is a rolling basis of admitting thereafter, after May 1st. So for students on the wait list, it's usually wait until after May 1st, and then we'll still be admitting then. If for varying reasons we're not able to admit any more from the wait list, that'll usually come around June time.
And also, when you get information about the wait list, there will be deadlines on there as
okay.
well. So it'll tell you by this time you should hear back from us. And that way you can kind of plan it out and things like that. And then follow up if after that part of the deadline has passed, then you can always follow up. But the communication for wait lists would include deadlines and when you should hear back.
Yeah, and to that point, I don't think we've talked about the optional essay with the wait list. So I mentioned earlier with opting in, students do have that. I think it is optional where students can report anything that hasn't been included in their application. Maybe something happened between December 1st and the time they received their decision that, oh, we really need to consider this, whether it was a project that they pursued that they didn't write about, or an opportunity they took advantage of, or a recognition they received. So there is that option to include a short or a brief essay for us to consider in considering them on the wait list.
And they will be reviewed, so it's not a wasted space.
Exactly.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Speaking about that, what if a student's not accepted and something happened between when they turned in their essay and when we send out admissions? To make it so that their application would be stronger at this point. Can they appeal? Can they...
Yeah, so we do have an appeal process that would be included for students, again, who aren't offered that admission. There are what we call FAQs for any student, really, for any of our applicants. And so if a student is not offered admission, if they go into their FAQs, there is an option to appeal the decision. And in that appeal, they are able to report in a very brief essay, again, anything else that hasn't been, again, considered in their application, anything that wasn't included in their application, or anything, like I said, that hasn't been included, or something that was new that happened from December to the time that they receive their decision. So there is an option for appeals. It is challenging, though not impossible, to be admitted off of an appeal case.
Yeah, it really has to be something new and compelling, I guess, is the term that we like to use.
Right.
And, of course, compelling is relatively subjective. But the idea is that we get a lot of appeals, and I've seen some of them, where they just say, I really, really, really wanted to get
right.
into Berkeley, or, you know, some form of that. And that's not really new or compelling.
That's all the questions that I had for you. Is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you wanted to add?
Not really. I think just to echo with holistic review, it really is looking at every aspect of the student. And the best way we do that, and the only way we can do that, is through the application. And so I just want to reiterate, with holistic review, we are considering your academic as well as your non-academic achievement. With academics, we are considering the full picture. So your GPA, any exams that you've taken, your overall, the courses that you've taken, the types of classes, all of that. But then also don't sell yourself short when you're talking about yourself and your application in terms of your personal insight questions, the experiences that you've had, but we consider everything in all of that. And so I think one of the challenges that students face is that our PIQs, or our personal insight questions, are very different in how students are used to writing. It's not an academic essay. It really is their narrative in a very, very brief form. So I think the biggest piece of advice that I can share is that it is your time to shine. And this really is an opportunity for you to brag about yourself, that we really want to know who you are as a student, as a community member, as a person in your family, whatever that might look like, that we are looking at every piece of you and of your application.
And just use your resources. The UCOP, Office of the President, UC Office of the President website has a lot of information on there in regards to how do you present yourself on the UC application, including the PIQ's personal insight question responses, and how do you write those. And it's not an essay. It's not a creative writing piece. It's not a writing sample. And it's different than the Common App. And all this stuff is on their website. So use your resources. Find the websites that can help you. Start with, UC Berkeley, berkeley.edu. Try that. And then Office of the President. So kind of do your research and kind of see. And if you're a junior or a sophomore, start filling out the application. And don't submit it because you're not done yet. But fill out an application and just see what the application is like and see what the questions are and how do you fill it out. And that way you can kind of get a jump start on, hey, this is what I have to plan to do in my senior year. So I've been telling a lot of students to do that, and they didn't know they could even make one. And mm-hmm. So anybody can make one.
Yeah, and I think for folks who are listening who might not be applying this year but are thinking about it and are trying to get familiar with the College of Engineering and with UC Berkeley, you are welcome to look at, like Henry said, at the University of California website. And you can find all of the personal insight questions listed there. I don't think it's ever too early to look at those and consider what you might want to write about. And even think about how you might want to set the next however many years you have left in high school. So I think having that preparation is always really helpful, whether that's drafting your personal insight questions before you even apply, or just getting familiar with some of the things that we look at in the application.
Yeah, and again, I don't know if we talked about this, but in the application, we only see what you put down, right? So we can't assume anything. And we do not use race or gender or religious affiliation or any of that information in the consideration of your application. So just know that ahead of time, that that's not a consideration. And that's one of the myths that we always get when we're on the road, that we get asked, I'm a woman, or I'm transgender, or I am white, or Caucasian, Asian, or whatever. Is that a negative or a positive or whatever? And it's not a consideration that we use when reviewing your application.
Mm-hmm. And with that said, you can talk about if that's an identity, if those are identities that impact you. Again, we're looking at you as an entire person, that while we might not consider that just as pieces of your application, if you feel it's necessary to write about how those identities have impacted you, that's definitely something you can do in the application, but it's the decision we make will not hinge on those identities.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, Denilyn and Henry, for coming by and talking to us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, definitely. It was really fun.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to the Not-So-Secret Guide to Being a Berkeley Engineer. I'm your host, Laura Vogt. And if you're looking at going to UC Berkeley and you want to know more about our resources, please, by all means, check out our other podcasts. We talk about students have given opinions about why you should choose to come to UC Berkeley, what they've liked about their time here. We've had the library come in, the Career Center, all kinds of different things to give you a little bit more of an insight and history into other resources that we have available for our students. So thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next time.
Good luck, everyone.
Go Bears.